Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to the show, and on this week's episode, I want to start to give a shout-out to some of my listeners and commenters out there who are digging Sci-Fi on Screen. So I want to devote an early bit of the show to kind of letting you guys know that I'm hearing you and reading you, and to give you a shout-out. I want to start with a couple of people on Facebook. Malk Foy, who's been with me early on and who gave me some suggestions on which shows that he'd like. So, Malk, thanks for listening, and appreciate having you out there. Also, Lee Hutchinson, who also found my show. And Lee wrote, just discovered your podcast, but by fluke, and enjoy listening to your back catalog that covers many of my favorite movies. Thank you, Lee. Appreciate it. And also want to give a shout out to Seth Heasley. Seth chimed in, and we've been kind of corresponding back and forth. And Seth hosts a terrific podcast called Take Me to Your Reader, which I recommend to any fans of my show. Seth does print SF and SF news and also film as well, and it's a terrific podcast, so urge you to check that out. Also want to give a thank you to Spot Allen, who Spot and I found each other on the History podcast group on Facebook. Spot called to my attention that Sci-Fi on Screen was not on Stitcher, and I didn't know anything about Stitcher, so thank you, Spot, for hipping me to Stitcher, and I got the show up on Stitcher, and I believe he subscribed. I want to thank Spot for this also little note that he wrote. Quote, your podcast has a serious flaw which needs to be brought to your attention. Halfway through every episode, I end up turning it off and going to watch the movie in question, end quote. And Spot, you know, probably one of the best things that I could hear from any listeners, that I'm inspiring you to go watch these films, because it's my enthusiasm for all these genre films that really, you know, drive me to do this. I love it. And I love the films, and I love talking about it. And so if I'm inspiring the same for people to hit pause and run to go watch the film, that's awesome. So again, thanks to Spot for that. Then I want to jump over to some Reddit comments, and this is pertaining to The Road Warrior. I got a few critical comments on Reddit, and the first one was from G.Y. Bryant. He basically posted on the thread, seems to be a guy just reading stuff from Wikipedia and describing what's happening on the screen. And yeah, in a short sentence, that's sort of what I do, but I like to think that I'm not reading from Wikipedia, that I'm paraphrasing and, you know, going into stuff if I'm interested in, that I'm not narrating scene by scene, you know, that I'm talking about why I think scenes work and why they don't work, and, you know, certain scenes inspire certain little sidetracks. And although I use the movie's scenes as a, you know, sort of a spine, I would like to think I'm doing more than just describing what's going on the screen. So we went back and forth a little bit and parted as friends, because I turned them on to some of the other podcasts that do similar things that I do, and I have them on my links page. He was happy to see that, so I think I made a friend, if not a listener. Then I got a comment from someone named Van Links Narek. It's a very long, long word on Reddit. You know, the first part of the comment was a little critical about me posting my own stuff, but I went back to Reddit and I took a look at the posting guidelines. And, you know, as long as I'm an active user of Reddit from time to time, if I want to post a link for something that I made, they're cool with it. So I was okay with that. And then the last piece of it was, anyway, I don't think a podcast is the right medium for an analysis like this, especially considering how visual these movies are. You'd need video, and that'd be pretty hard to get. I don't know about that. I mean, I think showing it on the video, yeah, I guess it would be cool, but an enormous amount of work, and then you're getting into copyright infringement and fair use and all that stuff, and I find this is a wonderful medium, and I guess I would love to hear from anyone if they think that's a valid idea of any kind, if they're frustrated a little bit with the podcast because of that kind of theme. I'd be curious. But so I thanked him for his comments, and and we went our separate ways, as we often do on the interwebs. That's the end of the feedback part of the show. I'm going to move into the film now. Night of the Living Dead, George A. Romero, 1968. Background. George A. Romero attended Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. In the 60s, he directed and produced TV commercials and industrial films for a company called The Latent Image, which he co-founded with some friend of his named John Russo and Russell Striner. So after a period of making commercials, I guess they were fairly successful, they decided they wanted to make a horror movie. They contacted an industrial firm called Hardman Associates and pitched an idea for Night of the Living Dead. Then they all kind of came together and formed a company called Image 10. Then that group, the initial budget for the film was $6,000. When they came together as Image 10, then they raised $114,000 for the film, which still a pittance. The writing of the film, it was originally co-written as like a horror comedy by this guy named John Russo and Romero under this title, Monster Flick. And an early draft was about the exploits of teenage aliens who visit Earth and befriend human teenagers. The second version of the script featured a man who runs away from home, discovers rotting corpses that aliens use for food. Russo also came up with the idea they'd be flesh eaters. Romero decided that he liked the ideas and that without those particular ideas that he'd be liable for ripping off Matheson's I Am Legend, which he basically says he does, and, you know, vampires instead of undead or ghouls instead of vampires. So the final draft then was much like the film you see today, reanimating human corpses, Romero referring to them as ghouls, consume the flesh of the living. Romero at some point explained that the script developed into a three-part short story, strangely enough. And part one was Night of the Living Dead, and then Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead were. So they had the story pretty laid out for the sequels, like before they even filmed the first two films, which I had no idea. I thought that was interesting. Influences. Romero says that he drew influence from a horror film called Carnival of Souls. It came out in 1962. I think it was a foreign film. I think it was Italian, possibly. Richard Matheson's, of course, I Am Legend novel, which, you know, everyone has read and loved, which I Am Legend was made three times. First as The Last Man on Earth, Vincent Price, then The Omega Man with Heston, and then Will Smith, actually, same title, I Am Legend, but very similar idea. You know, Romero is quoted as saying, I had written a short story which I basically ripped off from a Richard Matheson novel called I Am Legend. I mean, I've seen most of those films and I read a little bit of Matheson's book. And, you know, I think this is classic notion of an artist thinking he's really ripping something off. And he is, but, oh man, a lot of I Am Legend is a guy barricaded in a house. And I see that. But other than really the frame story, this movie has nothing to do with I Am Legend. It's a whole different animal and it's after a different game. And I think he stole what I call stealing well, meaning, you know, as an artist, as a young artist, when you're making things and, you know, you kind of just, you know, you do your cover tunes, you kind of steal what's already been out there. And if you're passionate about your art, you know, you're going to put your own stamp on it. And I think Romero totally did, as, you know, knowing I Am Legend. I mean, he could have started, you know, I would have never really figured it out. I think, because I think the only really frame device is, you know, they're stuck in a house and there are vampire / ghouls outside. But other than that, I think he knocked it out of the park. Okay, so let's get to the film. The first thing you notice about Night of the Living Dead is that it's in 4:3 ratio, sort of like the old TV set. Like it wasn't done in widescreen. And it's in black and white. It's like, you know, it really does not, when you watching horror films over the years and any kind of genre films, when you come upon this film, it does not feel like a horror movie when it first starts out. It feels like some strange Antonioni-like hybrid, some like Italian neorealist film in the beginning. You know, it's very weird how it starts out. It opens up on this lonely road and this very bleak-looking landscape. I think it was Pittsburgh, somewhere in Pittsburgh, outside of Pittsburgh. We follow this car while the credits roll. A very ominous, if old-school, sci-fi soundtrack plays. The soundtrack is very interesting in this film, and I'll talk more about it as I go. So we're introduced to Barbara and Johnny Blair, who are brother and sister, visiting their father's grave at the cemetery. And we get a throwaway line that it's 8 p.m. and still light. It doesn't, meaning that it's summer, and it doesn't look like summer. And there was a point in this film, it was in Pittsburgh and in autumn, there were some scenes where the actors couldn't open their mouths because, you know, their breath would come out. But you can tell on the drive up that most of the trees are bare, you know. And when they're in the cemetery, most of they're evergreens, so it's kind of, you can't really tell. But Yeah, it's kind of cool because you're getting this somber, bleak, scary kind of landscape of autumn, even when we're being told that it's summer. We see some strange noises come from the radio, and we hear that the radio station is just coming back online after some technical problems, which, you know, once you've watched this movie completely, you know exactly what has happened. Romero makes it a very creepy experience, panning up to the trees, a lot of handheld shots. Like, it's almost shot like a documentary. Like, he's just, you know, it's them with a camera running around the graveyard, and there's no one there. Like, it's a very ominous setup. It's very isolated, and they chose it for that reason. There's, I mean, not another person in sight. And already, as I'm watching it, it's starting to work on me. Like, I can feel the isolation that they're at this graveyard. No one else is around. It's kind of weird and bleak. Not knowing anything, you're watching this movie, I'm already kind of feeling a weird thing underneath, and I think that's the magic of this film. It works on so many amazing levels. Then we start to see the camera's just panning around, focusing on the siblings as they're kind of bickering over why they had to come out there. And finally, we see a guy in the background every once in a while, like behind, you know, one of the people. And the guy's slowly getting closer, you know, and it's like, we don't know anything. He's dressed in black. He's really weird. And then Barbara totally freaks out because they go into this thing where, you know, she used to get scared coming to the graveyard and Johnny would scare her. And now she's kind of freaked out. And then Johnny makes fun of her, and we get the immortal line from this filming, "They're coming to get you, Barbara." Then we see from the camera angles there are more people walking around now. I mean, now there's people. And then this creepy-looking dude winds up attacking Barbara, and Johnny intervenes, and the fight between them is incredible, very intense, a lot of close-ups and cuts. It's almost very modern in how it was shot. It's a very frenzied thing, and the camera's very close, and there's a lot of cuts, and there's a lot of weird angles. It's canted and you know, it makes the whole thing very weird and very intense. The guy winds up dashing Johnny's head against a gravestone, and he's out and possibly dead, and then starts coming after Barbara. And now I have one nit here in that, you know, why doesn't the guy start eating Johnny, right? Because he's got a guy, he wants to eat him. Johnny's knocked out, and now he comes after Barbara. And I think it was more of the filmmakers not wanting to tip their hand. I think it takes a while for this film to work up to the cannibalism angle. And I think if you threw that at the viewer right now, the guy starts chowing down on Johnny, the movie becomes way more schlocky, you know? And the fact that he doesn't, you know, we're still working the horror angle now. We're still working tension. You know, the man is after Barbara. Barbara is running. We haven't been shocked yet. And I think it's very smart of Romero to wait. Anyway, so now we're getting these scares as, you know, Barbara can barely run. She takes off her shoes and this guy is following her and she gets in the car and closes the windows, but no keys. And now the guy is there and he tries to get in and it's a scary scene. The actor they chose to play this guy is a really creepy looking dude. The ghouls in this film, which will eventually become known as zombies, but they're not named in this film. One must take note, the word zombie is never used, which I think is brilliant. They pick up and use tools in this film, and I don't remember that in a lot of the films subsequently, but so this guy picks up a rock and he's smashing out the window, and then Barbara lets the emergency brake go and the car starts to roll down this hill. And great tension when she crashes because this guy is still lurching down the street after her. And it's not really a slow zombie. It's not a fast zombie, but he's kind of like aggressive and a little quick. Like, again, the zombies in this film had an urgency to them. They weren't these lumbering, dull things. Like, they kind of were, but there were some of them that were a little more agitated, shall we say. And I think it works. And now we get the music. Now, a little word about the music. The music that's used, they couldn't afford to do a soundtrack, so they stole all this Commons music from bad 50s sci-fi films and stole it and put it in this movie. And I have written down a little later what movies they came from. But the music is out of date, and it's kind of like really like Plan 9 kind of music. But it's kind of cutting-edge modern filmmaking for 1968. Like, this was amazingly shot, I think, for the budget and you know, the way this is his first feature. Like, it's pretty incredible. And you're getting music that normally comes with, you know, bug-eyed aliens and flying saucers and all kinds of crap. So it's a weird mix. Every once in a while, there's a more sedate music cue, and it works, but there's a lot of this where the music is just really like old-fashioned, you know, alien horror. It doesn't really work, but it's an anachronism now and part of the movie, you know, but it's weird. So off in the distance now, Barbara sees this house and attempts to get in. And again, great, great tension. Everything's locked. She can't get in anywhere, and the guy's still after her. And the camera is everywhere. low angles, high angles, Dutch angles. Like, it's such a wacky camera. And so I don't know how it escaped being schlock, because it's not schlock. But some of those camera angles and edits, they should be schlock, but it's not. And I can't figure it out. Maybe because it's black and white. You know, you get the wacko music, you got these crazy angles, you got old-fashioned monster coming to get you, and there's something more to it. Still to this day, I can't put my finger on it, although I shall try. So she finally gets into the house and locks the door, and there's this great creepy moment where she's just crouching down by the door, and there are shadows all around her. Romero does wonderful things with the shadows in the house. There's a lot of shots where characters are standing in the light, but they're surrounded by shadows from the house. And I think it's very cool, very interesting. Barbara's in the house alone, and we as viewers don't know anything about what's in the house. So it's Tension City, you know, like you can't go wrong here. The actress playing Barbara, Judith O'Day, is fantastic. You know, I think she does with Barbara amazing things, which not easy to do, because Barbara basically becomes this catatonic zombie in her own right. But there's something about O'Day's performance that's very compelling, that she... I don't think she really mails it in. And sometimes you get frustrated with her as a character, but I never stop believing that Barbara is going through what she's going through, you know? It's important that she doesn't recover too well from this insanely horrifying experience of this guy attacking her brother and chasing her. Like, you know, if she recovers too quick, suddenly I'm not in the movie as much in some weird way. I don't know if that makes any sense. But her terror and insanity is palpable, man, and I'm totally on board. So we're in, you know, classic scare setup. No one's around. We don't know who's behind every door. Night is falling outside, and more ghouls are approaching the house. And then, you know, she goes upstairs, and she runs into the previous owner of the house, which is a rotted cadaver. She's about to bolt out the front door of the house, and all of a sudden there's these white lights, and we don't know what it is. And it's the car, and there's this character named Ben, played by Dwayne Jones, enters the house with her, locks the door. At this point, Barbara is completely catatonic. Ben can't get anything out of her. So you get this incredible frustration from Ben. I mean, they're in this impossible situation, facing these impossible events, and he can't communicate to this woman. It's real, and there's something about it that works really well. Outside, we see the ghouls are messing with Ben's car. So Ben comes outside, and they're putting out the headlights, and he downs one of them with a crowbar, and then another one comes on him, and one gets by him and enters the house. And we see it enter the house, and Barbara's completely unaware, and it's advancing on her. Again, you know, this is the beginning of the classic zombie terror to me, which that's why I love fast zombies are okay. I'm not against fast zombies, but the slow zombie is just so much more opportunity for terror, because you get scenes like this where Judith's cowering in a corner, she's helpless, and the slow march of the ghoul towards her. It's not happening in a hurry, so there's plenty of time for us to freak out and be like, is Ben coming back in? Is Ben coming back in? You know, and feel the tension. Because the zombies aren't fast, they take the time, and you get that incredible tension that if you're impaired in any way, this inexorable advance of the ghoul is quite a thrilling thing. I mean, and of course, just before it gets to her, Ben intervenes, kills it with his crowbar, but the front door still opens, so we see another figure attempt entry. Like, you know, it's like stemming, trying to keep out water. Ben finally, you know, gets rid of them and closes the door. So our first little sequence here, I mean, the inexorable advance of the ghouls is such an incredible device that will be used by Romero and dozens of others in the coming decades to great effect. And what's great here is the complete ignorance of what's going on. They're not named as zombies. We don't know anything about zombies. There are just these figures. It seems like they're just coming out of the woodwork. And Romero already has shown us that he knows how to create tension and horror. He knows how to do the, I'm stuck, something's coming towards me, and I'm not going to get out of it right away. There's a point where Ben drops the crowbar, when he leaves the door open. Like, any normal human behavior, a mistake, you know, leaves you open to being devoured by these things, and it just creates an incredible amount of tension. It would have been something if Romero had created the genre and sucked at it, and then other people perfected it, but not only did he create the genre, he perfected it in the first film. All of the tropes, and I'll get to that later about, you know, what he mastered in this film, but you really get how good he is at creating tension. And the added fact that he and Barbara can't communicate because of her hysteria, so you're frustrated because they can't even communicate with each other, like, what's going on, because of Barbara's sort of being catatonic. Everything is just so out of joint and weird all at once, and it works phenomenally well. I don't think this film dates, because you know, other than it being shot in 1968 and being black and white, I mean, it's so up to date in terms of how to create tension and horror. And you know, the performances at times can be a little dated, but again, you can watch this movie today, put the lights out, get your popcorn, and you're in for a ride. The only problem really is the goofy music at times, which becomes a little overbearing. But rarely have folks done better than Romero has done here. Ben finds out, you know, how to fight the ghouls. He lights one of them on fire, and then the rest of them back off. So we see that they're, you know, they're repulsed by fire, which is cool. And now we follow Ben in the house. He's gathering all these weapons and tools from drawers, and Barbara's just basically sent on an errand to get wood. So she kind of can understand what's going on, but she's catatonic still and in shock. At one point, she hits a button on this music box, and this very innocent lullaby comes through, all this madness. And I thought, what a genius idea. It made me think of the wind-up musical box in The Road Warrior, when Max picks it up and turns it, and then he gives it to the feral kid. In the midst of this carnage and horror, this pure, innocent sound. I always wonder if Miller got it from that this moment of her playing with the music box. So she starts to come out of it a little bit, and her and Ben and I are boarding up all the windows and all the doors to try to keep the dead out. And there's no dialogue, which is terrific. It's all very, you know, it's this film in a lot of ways, and I guess, you know, a lot of zombie films have understood this too, very task-oriented. You find out about the characters by what they do. There's not a lot of jibber-jabber in terms of character building. It's all about doing. Like, what are we doing next? What do we have to do? Who wants to do it? Who doesn't want to do it? And why? And I like this. There's an extended amount of time where just Ben and Barbara are boarding up the house, you know? Then we get a little kind of an old school acting monologue by Ben as he tells Barbara all about his first encounter with the dead by a diner before he got into the house. And it kills me because it's a really cool scene he describes about a tanker truck being attacked. And like, it's a great scene about what he witnessed. And there's a part of me that wished Romero had the budget to film it. And somehow, instead of him narrating it, that we would have saw it all. But I don't know, maybe it would have been too much too soon to do, you know, maybe too much spectacle, because this film is all about building, slowly building tension and horror and tension and horror. You know, maybe he knew what he was doing when he narrated it, so very curious. We have Barbara talking about her journey, and, you know, both actors having their moment. They're given nice long monologues with long takes, and both actors are very good. There's not a lot of bullshit writing here, so they're just very solid. They're scared to death. They're taking this whole thing extremely seriously, which I think is probably a rare thing for films. Like, Romero both gave them long art movie-ish actor monologues in what purports to be a horror movie. You know, where horror movies that came before this, you didn't get a lot of acting. You know, you got a lot of yelling and screaming and goofiness. And, you know, now you've got, like, you've just had a real weird horror scare. And now you get these two long actor monologues where they're crying and they're really expressing their emotions. And it's great, you know. It keeps the film very grounded in some ways. You know, you're not off on, if it was a modern film, there'd be, you know, cursing the one asshole guy, you can't wait to die. Like, it would have been into the tropes already. Here, they want to make a good movie, you know. So just another interesting tidbit here. And at the end of Barbara's monologue, she kind of loses it. Ben has to slap her, which is very old school Hollywood. Like, get a hold of yourself. Made me think of Airplane, you know. She hits him first, to be sure, and he hits her back. But it's an interesting moment. Finally, now we escalate a little bit. And they find the radio, which is working, and we find the emergency station. And we hear a very professional radio voice talking about this epidemic of mass murder. In that moment, the dead are closing back in on the house. So Ben soaks a chair in lighter fluid, drags it outside, lights it, so moves them back, you know, keeping them at bay. The tension never lets up in this movie. You know, all we're hearing is the radio discussing the situation, and then we're watching Ben and Barbara board up the house, which is really great because we're getting an info dump, but done in a way, to me, that's very artful. You know, we're seeing the actors do practical things, and now we're getting, you know, at this point in the film, we're kind of starved for a little info, like, okay, what the hell's going on out there? And so we don't know too much more. But we do hear, you know, kind of the news saying there's an epidemic of mass murder. Nothing about the dead, nothing about anything yet, just mass murder, which is great. So it's, you know, they're slowly building. During this, Ben finds a shotgun and some shells. And it's very cute. He finds shoes for Barbara because she had to leave her high heels in the cemetery when she was running. And he puts them on her feet while she's still in shock. It's kind of a cute little moment. And then we hear one brief line on the radio, you know, victims show signs of having been partially devoured by their murderers, right? So we're starting to get the ghoulish part of this film now. Ben goes upstairs, drags the corpse into a room, leaving Barbara alone downstairs, and then the camera focuses on this door, which previously had been overlooked, and it opens up and two men come out and she screams. Ben runs downstairs and then we find out that there are people in the basement the entire time hiding out. And so the new people we get are this kid and his girlfriend, the Coopers, old man Cooper and his wife and their child. So we're getting now we're setting up a, you know, another classic trope of the genre, the internal conflict between the group, right? So this old guy, Cooper, comes up and we can tell that he's very angry and scared. Immediately, you know, Ben puts it to him like, didn't you hear what was going on up here? Didn't you hear her scream? And we get the sense that he pretty much did, but he declined to help. You know, now we get this conflict where Cooper's like, the basement is the safest place. They're arguing and you know, Cooper's like, we're going down to the basement. And we hear that he has a wife and a kid in the cellar, that the kid is hurt. They have this great practical debate about what's safer, upstairs or downstairs. And, you know, Ben puts forth, like, we can see what's going on up here. And if they get the better of us, we can at least take off. Cellar is a one-way trip. You know, if they get through that door, we're dead. So there's this kid who's kind of in the middle of it, who's down there with the Coopers and kind of sides with Ben a little bit. And then we get this brief scare when Ben walks past one of the back windows and some arms grab him. He shoots the ghoul once. Nothing happens. Shoots it again. Finally, we see a headshot and it goes down, but we're not given that bit of data yet that comes later. And this whole thing is shot really well because it's just like a couple of hands coming in the boarded up window and the gun and the camera angles. He puts the camera right there and it makes it a very tense scene. You know, even this little moment where this, you know, the zombie's trying to get him. Very tense scene, you know, just I'm always more every as we go through this film, I'm more and more impressed with how Romero shoots this bloody thing, and not surprisingly, how well it stands up because of it. So now the kid brings up his girlfriend. Cooper himself retreats down the cellar, locks themselves in. And now we cut downstairs, so finally we're with a new group of people. So it's basically Cooper and his wife and his kid, and we can tell that they hate each other, him and his wife. His wife is totally giving him shit about not going up to help, and they're arguing, and she's definitely on Ben's side, not wanting to be locked in the basement, and then when she finds out they have a radio upstairs, she's like, you know, we have to go up and hear what's going on. So the kid sends his girlfriend down to watch the girl, and the Coopers both come up. And in the last shot before the Coopers come up, we see the girl has a bandage on her arm. And, you know, again, the man is inventing an entire genre, you know, scene by scene, because that bandage and that wound plays a part in the film to come. So upstairs, you know, Mrs. Cooper's trying to console Barbara, but she's really slipped into like a catatonic state. They find a television and they turn it on, and then we get this great, you know, newsroom footage where they're confirming the flesh eating. We get this very realistic read by the newsman that people who have recently died are returning to life to kill and eat the flesh of their victims. And they tell folks now that they're urged to do not stay locked in their houses, to get to a rescue station, and they start listing the stations on the screen. And it's all, you know, to me, it's great because this is any, you know, forget that it's the ghouls, any emergency, this is how, you know, things would behave. This is how the world would react. And I think that verisimilitude makes this film, again, it keeps it grounded in kind of a realism where, you know, future zombie movies kind of get way out. But this is a very gritty, realistic movie because the TV news guy could be talking about a flood or a fire or like an earthquake. It just happens to be ghouls. So the realism of how they're handling it and how we hear them talking about it, we've heard news people talk about this all the time whenever there's a disaster, right? So that's real to us. And then the fact that it's just about the ghouls, it's, you know, he's putting down the idea of The Walking Dead, but he's delivering it in such a realistic package that we can't help but be like on board. So the first idea is about this truck outside. Outside this house is a gas station. The gas pump is locked, and they start talking about possibilities. And back on the news, we get some more information about NASA being consulted about the event, and we hear that a Venusian satellite was destroyed on its return back from Venus, and it brought back some unknown radiation. There's a great moment where we get a newsman in the field somewhere in Washington trying to chase down some scientists. The scientist is like, yes, the probe definitely has to do with what's going on. And the military guy's like, well, we don't really know right now. And again, it's the same bullshit non-answer that people, you know, that politicians and notable figures give when they don't really know what's going on. And it's the same thing with the newsreader, where you're getting a realistic reaction of the world to something that's, you know, supernatural or really weird. And the mix of it is dynamite. So finally, the idea is to kind of, you know, board up everything, but make Molotov cocktails, drive the dead back, get the truck over to the gas tank, fill it up, and head to one of these rescue stations. So the kid is the only one who can handle the truck, so him and Ben decide to go together. There's a total next guy who's going to die scene between the kid and his girlfriend, which is dragged out a little bit longer. And, you know, she winds up dying too. But it's so funny. It's just sort of like, you know, nowadays, being such savvy film goers, we're sort of like, oh, man, this kid's dead, you know. So, you know, the women go downstairs. They lock themselves in, and the men enact the plan. And it's cool. You know, Cooper goes upstairs. He's got Molotov cocktails, and he creates this sort of cordon of fire backing off the ghouls. There's a couple of old school sort of guy on fire stunt work, which is kind of nice. And the kid makes it to the truck, but then out of nowhere, the girlfriend runs out, like, I can't leave you. I'm going to go with you. Gets in the truck with him. So Ben's keeping all the ghouls back with his torch while they're trying to fuel the truck while the dead advances. And it's just classic, you know, zombie tension. And the kid makes a mistake and he sprays some fuel on the ground and it ignites, lights the truck on fire. Then he jumps in with his girlfriend, drives it away. Ben tries to put out what's left on the ground, and the truck completely explodes, kills the kid and the girlfriend. But Ben now is outside, trapped, cut off from the house. Somehow he evades them all and gets into the house. And we can see that the door was locked, and Ben had to smash it open. And when he gets in, he sees Cooper hesitating by the basement door. And he's like, Ben's just like, hey, like, you douchebag. Cooper helps Ben barricade the door back up. And as soon as it's done, Ben just beats the crap out of Cooper until he's basically immobile on the ground. Because he's like, you know, you fucking douchebag. You did that again. And it's real, man. I mean, it's a real visceral scene where you don't blame Ben in the slightest. And now you get the piece de resistance of this film where the dead converge on the dead couple in the car and they start chowing down. And we see them pulling out entrails and eating organs and some guy's eating a liver, intestines, and it's gross. Oh man, this is the part, and I love this film, but you know, all of Romero's dead eating scenes are similarly creepy and gross at the same time. It's very hard to watch, but again, he makes it seem real. They're eating these body parts, you know, and they're passing them around and just chowing down on them. And it's gross, but putting you right in the scare. Like, this is what's going to happen, you know, should you fail in any way. So now we hear from the news about if anyone that you know has been bitten by, you know, that you have to, or anyone's been recently killed by the ghouls, they need to be burned right away. And we hear that the child has been bitten by one of them on the arm. So Cooper tells Ben how they came to be at the house, and then Barbara, in her weird kind of catatonism, lets them know that they have a car. Of course, they don't have the keys. On the news, we hear about this mysterious radiation and how now the levels have just increased everywhere. We see our first footage of our ghoul-killing posse, which, you know, you can transport it to Mississippi in the 40s and 50s. It would not be out of place. The same posse will come back near the end of the film, which we will see. Again, another realistic sequence where they're talking very practically about, you know, the dead, and the main guy leading them is very laconic Southern drawl. Yeah, I wanted to take a headshot. You know, very much like your man on the scene, very realistic. Then we hear them being called ghouls now, you know, no zombie in this film. We get an extensive interview with the sheriff. It's terrific. It looks like documentary footage, feels like it. You know, I feel also, too, that Romero puts in that, you know, in a situation like this, those with power and weapons are the ones who are going to immediately band together and rise and be the ones in charge in just a very subtle way. I mean, yeah, that's the case, but there's something about how he shoots it so matter-of-factly. That's just like, yeah, in a situation like this, it's people with guns and motivation and a group who will come together to, you know, rise to the top, which really forms a lot of the, in a lot of subsequent zombie movies, you know, how things have turned out in the sort of the post-zombie apocalypse and how groups are made up and lots of military units still around and all that. It makes total sense, you know. So now we're getting our end game. The power goes out in the house and the tension gets ratcheted up. And the dead now begin basically a full-on assault on the house, using clubs and rocks to pound on the doors and, you know, freaking everyone out. It's a lot of close-ups on faces here. Cooper's not helping anybody. He wants the rifle because he realizes that, you know, Ben's in charge because of the gun. At some point, you know, he goes for the rifle, even as the dead are trying to get in, and covers Ben. And now him and Ben struggle for the weapon, and Ben recovers it and kills Cooper, just as the doors are splintering. So now Cooper crawls downstairs and dies at the foot of his daughter from the gunshot. And Helen's about to be taken, and finally Barbara snaps out of it and, you know, saves her and shuts the door. Now Helen goes downstairs and catches the daughter eating her father, and it totally shocks her and benumbs her, and she collapses, and the girl advances and takes a sharp trowel and kills her. And again, weird, you know, like Romero's zombies are, in this first film, you know, they use weapons. They use sticks and clubs, and, you know, this child, from what we come to know of zombies, should have just kind of advanced and just started eating her. But she takes a sharp trowel and kills her, and it's done in a very psycho-like way. You know, you see the shadow of the arm moving, and then you hear the music, and then you hear the blood spilling, and then her dead eyes, and right out of Psycho, but very creepy. Very, very creepy. And so now it's really Ben and Barbara against the multitude. They're in the house now, and Barbara comes face-to-face with her brother, Johnny, who grabs her, takes her into the midst of the throng where she's torn apart. Ben is taken and almost bitten by the little girl, but he barricades himself downstairs as the horde enters the house. Then in the basement, he sees both the Coopers, and Mr. Cooper now rises since he was just killed. Ben headshots him, puts him down. He forgets about Helen, who opens her eyes, and he has to turn and kill her as well. And then Ben's just in the basement, and the dead are just screaming upstairs, and it's like really creepy. But now we cut to, it's a beautiful day, bucolic setting around the house. The dead seemingly have gone. Chopper flies overhead, and that ghoul-killing posse is now in the area. Guns loaded for bear. We have a small posse of cops, deputies, and dogs advancing on the house. And again, it could be a lynching posse back in the South, back in the day. It's very realistic. But Ben hears the dogs, and he hears the shots as the posse are clearing the area of dead. And so we're now cross-cutting, building tension between the posse cutting down the dead and Ben slowly going up the steps, you know, entering the living room, about to leave the house. And of course, he advances towards the window. The posse thinks he's one of the dead. He's pegged right between the eyes and dead. And then you get these stills, still photography with the voiceover, which is a very wonderful way to end this film. Very chilling and very intense. Still photography of the men in the house and Ben on the ground and the bodies being burned. And the voiceover, still, we're still hearing the guys just bullshitting with each other like they're out hunting moose, you know? Again, you can't help but think of some of the civil rights photographs. And Romero will tell you to this day that that was not what he was after. And I could kind of believe it, you know, but the realism here is very stark, and that the technique of the still photographs and the voiceover, really amazing, you know? And that's how we end. Very, very downer ending, you know, as a lot of the films in the late 60s, early 70s were. These downer endings that were like, nope, don't work out in the end. It all goes to pot. Parallax View, I think of, and Deer Hunter. And to summarize, I mean, why I think this film still works, first of all, the acting is really good, and it's given, you know, they really give it their all, and they really are sold on these characters. I don't feel like any of these actors are fashion models or pretty kids who just, you know, were first in central casting. Like, they look like just working actors who are really in their roles, and the human drama between Cooper and Ben really keeps the middle of the movie going, which is, you know, I think is very smart. The camera angles that Romero uses are crazy. Lots of intense close-ups. The story is crackerjack, one thing after the next, very lean, not a lot of BS. You know, the music used in the film, so as I was talking about earlier, I think it cost them like $1,500 for everything. It was originally used in a film called Teenagers from Outer Space, made in 1959, so that's where that's from. And look, the tropes that this film sets out, right? The zombies are slow walking, shooting zombies in the head. The zombies are cannibals. The trope of one party of heroes being bitten and turning. Like, there's always one person in the zombie film who's in the crew who got bit, and whether or not they'll turn. That's set up here. The inner conflict between parties is always some asshole in the group of people who's running from the zombies who we hate and who's going to fuck everything up. He did all of that here. And he added an incredible layer of like weird neo-Italian realism, you know, the way it was shot, the black and white, the documentary stuff, the news stuff. Like, there's this thread of realism that goes throughout the whole film that the film doesn't blink at you or wink at you in any way. It presents this in a completely serious and sober way. You know, it's up to you to take it in or not. And I think the success of Romero here is exactly that. He's like, I'm going full bore here. We're not winking. It's not Vincent Price horror anymore. This is new horror. It's straight, and it's creepy and gruesome, and we're going to take pride in doing... The actors are going to be good. We're going to try to do a good script. We're going to take it seriously, and I can't imagine what this must have been like when it came out, and I mean, it was a huge hit, but still, you know, one hell of a movie. So a little bit of trivia. Around the time that this came out, Reader's Digest published this little thing that going to see the, you know, they were afraid if people were going to go see this movie that it would inspire them to be cannibals. Again, the word zombie never used in this film. Not sure when it started, but not in this film. And the sad part about this is Romero made no money from this film. And as of today, the film's in the public domain. At the time of the film's release, any work that did not include a copyright notice was assumed to be public domain. So that meant if you put something out, if you didn't apply for a copyright, legally it was assumed that your work was public domain. I think that loophole's been closed now. There's like an assumption that's going on. But since the filmmakers were young and stupid, they forgot to include this notice. The film slipped into public domain. And it wasn't until 1989 that they struck that down, that a copyright notice was no longer required, you know, that that stuff could be worked out later. But so he made this, he remade this in color back in, I think, in 1990. And basically, people always are like, why? You know, I don't think he directed it. A guy named Tom Savini, who I think did the effects in this film, directed the remake. But George Romero, it was basically a story remake with the woman being the stronger character at this point, not being a catatonic. He basically remade it because he wanted to make some money, that he made nothing off of the original film. And he thought, well, I'll just remake it in color and hopefully it'll be a huge hit and I'll make up what I didn't make on the first film. But as anyone who's seen it, it is quite okay, but completely unnecessary film. Like, it's watchable, but it's nothing special, and it has quite fallen away in power versus this film. So the franchise, obviously, Romero has continued on. Sequel Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, Land of the Dead, Diary of the Dead, Survival of the Dead. I think I may be missing one. I'm probably going to cover them all because it's an incredibly important franchise. And most of them are actually good. Diary of the Dead is the only one that I think is really not very good. But they're solid. Dawn of the Dead is a classic in itself. Day of the Dead, okay, solid. Land of the Dead, I think, is really good. Survival of the Dead, I have to rewatch. It's been a while. But when he gets down to doing a dead movie, he knows what he's doing. And most of them are really good. And obviously, it spawned, I feel like, every other movie that comes out today, 2015, has to do with zombies, you know? So he created, single-handedly created a genre, in my opinion. Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen, to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com. Or feel free to leave a comment on the website, www.scifionscreen.com, and you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support scifionscreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/scifionscreen, and that's Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us, again, our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page, and on any smartphone, you could search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.